WFAE's recent public conversation on the city's homicide count led one of our panelists to expand on what he says is a major contributing factor to the problem, the feeling that incarceration is normal, that being hauled off in handcuffs is a badge of honor. This, he says, stems from America's get-tough-on-crime policy and the war on drugs that has led us to having the highest incarceration rate in the civilized world. But truth be told, those policies most severely impact minorities and the poor. According to the PBS program Frontline, 2.2 million people are incarcerated in the United States, but more than 4.7 million people are on parole or probation. That's a fact with which we should reckon. We need to understand that many of those who go to prison, most, in fact, are going to get out. Yet we do little to help them prepare for a better life in society. On the contrary, we put up numerous roadblocks to success. Many of our current policies create barriers to employment, education, housing, healthcare, and civic participation. We are setting them up for failure and the commission of additional crimes and a return to prison, all costly outcomes. Gemini Boyd knows this all too well. He was sentenced at the age of 16 for his role in a 1990 shooting at Myers Park High School. He was locked up for that for 3 years for assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury. That juvenile conviction came back to haunt him when he was convicted on a federal drug conspiracy charge in 1996. His previous conviction led to a 19-year sentence. He served that time, and after his release founded Project BOLT. That's an acronym for Building Outstanding Lives Together. He was that panelist during our public conversation to whom I referred a moment ago, and he joins us again to talk more about the obstacles to success faced by so many after prison. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can reach us through Facebook or on Twitter at charlottetalks, and you can watch the program this morning on Facebook Live. Let's talk about your story for a minute. As I said, you were sentenced at 16 and served 3 years. Did you serve as a juvenile back then, or did you serve in an adult situation because of our laws in North Carolina?
No, I was at the time, HB 280 hadn't been created. So I was sentenced as an adult, and I served 3 years for assault with a deadly weapon.
With adults in prison? No,
you weren't with adults, but you was in adult courtroom, an adult setting. So you go to what they call Morganton High Rise. That back then, that's what they had, Morganton High Rise. They had Sand Hills. They had Pope Youth Center. They were youth, but at some point that some individuals, you could be 18 and some individuals would be 20, 21.
So how long after you got out from serving that time did you find yourself in trouble again?
Well, I found myself in trouble again at the age of 22. I was 22 years old. And I think it stemmed from when I was incarcerated the first time as a youth that there wasn't a whole lot for me to, like, gain knowledge-wise as an adult. There was no one to really teach me how to become a man. Mm. So it led to me to come home and do things that I didn't have no business doing, but to an extent. And I received 30 years, 360 months in federal prison here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I served 20 years of the 30 years. I was released due to Obama's reduced sentences for nonviolent criminals because my case was a nonviolent situation. There was no drugs, no guns, no wiretap, no anything to lead to my conviction. It was just hearsay that led to the conviction.
Yeah, that conviction was what? So conspiracy?
Back then they had this thing called a fit-all drug conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And they was just coming through the black neighborhoods and they were just locking up individuals for conspiracy and giving them drug kingpin charges when most individuals were selling $5 or $10 bags of cocaine. Mm-hmm. And back then they had the 100-to-1 ratio, which is still astounding because it's like this. If I take this bottle of water and I put it in the freezer, it freezes to ice. But when I take it out of the freezer and let it thaw out, what does it turn back to? Water. Mm-hmm. And that's the same analogy that you can use with cocaine and crack cocaine. They were the same. And they were sentencing individuals like myself to long prison terms.
What did you do? What did they accuse you of doing? What, in fact, did you do?
Conspiracy. I did. And don't get me wrong. I have sold drugs in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But did I sell drugs to go do 20 years? Because the number one consumer of any drugs in the United States is the white male. He makes the least population in prison. Mm. How is it that he's the number one consumer in the drug trade, but he's the least populated in prison?
So when you were in prison the first time, did they do anything? You were in high school. You're 16.
I was 16 years old.
Did they do anything for you? Did you get a GED? Did you graduate from high school while you were in prison? Did they give you life skills training? Did they do anything for you?
I received a GED because I wanted a GED. Mm-hmm. And I took the initiative to want that GED. They had school. They had classes set up that you could go to and that you can learn from. They even had, back then it was more money being spent on reentry form and things of that nature. And you had an opportunity. I had small engineer repair, welding, carpentry. I did all that.
So you had skills.
I had skills. I did that. Then I did. But I really wasn't taught how it could affect my life once I transitioned back into society.
How using those skills could
exactly
affect your life? It was the disconnect. They didn't put the two together.
They didn't put the two together for me to understand that this is a way you can actually make a living, and this is the way you can one day develop a business, you know, things that have.
But had they told you that, because it's part of the problem with drugs, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on drugs, so that's not what this program is about. But part of the problem with drugs is that if you're good at it, you can make a lot of money, and a lot more money than you can being a car mechanic or being a shopkeeper or whatever it seems to me. You can make a lot of money fast. Dangerous. Find yourself in prison again. But that's attractive to a lot of people.
Yes, attractive because they are uneducated about the circumstances behind selling drugs.
Okay.
Like no one knows when they're at that age that you're going to get locked up and go do 30 years in prison. No one knows about 841A1C.
And at our public conversation, you made mention of the fact that I'd never heard before, and I think that many of our listeners probably had never heard before, that being in prison seems to be, for a lot of people in that community, the norm. And it's not a shame. It's a badge of honor.
Yes.
So when you're up against that, how do you make normalcy look attractive?
Because first of all, it's like I told you in the last setting that we was in, 90% of the individuals that have been incarcerated suffer from what we all know as post-incarceration syndrome. And it is passed on to the kids because I say normalcy because they develop an idea of a mindset that they can be incarcerated and it's okay. Mm. And it stems from individuals in their families or individuals in their community that is incarcerated for long periods of time, and they see police come in and out of neighborhoods, of black neighborhoods, locking individuals up. So at 5 years old, a child has the notation to think, okay, my father, my brother, my mother, whoever, always going in and out of prison. So he or she starts to think that, okay, one day I'm going to go to prison. I'm not going to go to college, but I'm going to go to prison.
Right.
And that's okay. Then when they hit 16 years old, they start acting out. They start doing violent crimes, selling drugs and things like that. And we try to save them. But at that time, it's too late.
Did you think that way?
Of course.
So you went to prison. You went to federal prison after you served the juvenile sentence. You went to federal prison. What is that like?
So, man, it's so hardening on the heart, the mind, the spirit, and everything to be placed with 30 years over your head at the age of 22. You can say an individual that goes to college is still a child, but you tell me when I'm 21 or 22 years old in prison, I'm a man. Mm-hmm. But there's the difference right there. But because I'm not in college, I'm not a child. But because I sold drugs once before in my life, I'm a man now.
Right.
And there's no difference because an individual's brain doesn't starts to understand life to the age of 25. Your brain is still processing information.
Right.
It's still developing.
Right.
So if I make a mistake at 21 or 22 years old, you telling me that you should send me away for the next 30 years? I didn't kill no one.
And they say, I mean, you're in an adult prison. What prison did you go to?
I was at 9 different prisons. I was at some of the worst prisons. I was actually at a prison in Louisiana. They call it Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They called it Afghanistan because every day there was violent acts. It was more murders in 1 year in the prison than it was in the surrounding county.
So in those situations, in those 9 prisons, what did they do for you and other people who were going to get out? I'm sure there were some people serving life sentences.
Yes.
But for those that they knew were going to be released at some point in their lives, what, if anything, did they do or make available to you?
You know, this is what excuse my humor, because this is humorous to me. They did nothing.
Was it there if you asked for it?
They had nothing provided for you, because in 1995, the ADAP law that Bill Clinton demolished took all the resources from the prisons. So there is nothing. And when I tell you, it's like you being in a desert of sand and you searching for water. You have no water. And that water in particular is what I'm saying is humanity. Mm-hmm. Or having an understanding of knowing that I'm going to go home one day.
So they had no life skills classes. They had no counseling. They had no educational opportunities. They had no job training programs. Nothing? Nothing?
I worked in the psychology department where I was at. Mm-hmm. And you have psychologists that are actually in the building. And they're getting paid maybe $100,000 a year through the prison system. But you know who the individuals were that were actually treating the individuals coming in for the psychiatric evaluations and understanding of prison life? It were individuals like me and other individuals that were actually prisoners. Mm-hmm. The psychologists and everyone else, they just sit in their office. When the individuals come in, they say, oh, yeah, you have such and such coming in to see you now this morning.
But they had no anger management classes, nothing like that?
They
did have things
like
that.
But the sad part is, how can anger management be implemented in the prison system and I'm teaching it? You see what I'm saying? I come from being angry.
Right.
So how can I teach anger management and I'm the one that's angry? So
did you teach it?
Yes.
So what did you say to these guys?
Well, you have to just let an individual know that he has to recognize his anger and he has to find out where it stems from. I don't, maybe it's just a God gift. I don't know. You know, I dealt with drug rehabilitation, I taught, anger management, I taught.
Did you speak, I only have a minute left in the segment, but did you speak while you were in prison to authorities or after you've gotten out, because I know you're working to help others coming out of prison, about how crazy this is not to get people ready to come out?
I spoke on it all the time, but they don't care. This is the sad part. Taxpayers are paying money right now today for the 2.3 million people that are incarcerated in the United States. And no one cares about the person that's in prison because they feel as though once they get their time, they go do their time. But it's deeper than that. If you want to heal society and lift individuals up when they bring them back to the community, we have to start uplifting them within the prison system. You can't wait till they come home and expect a change, and you never taught them nothing for the last 10 years.
Gemini Boyd is our guest. He is a community activist, the founder and CEO of something we'll talk about when we come back, Project Bolt, Building Outstanding Lives Together. And we'll also talk about the roadblocks that people being released from prison face, which really prohibit them from being successful as a citizen in life in many cases. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the new Sweet Cayenne Cajun Filet Sandwich with jalapeno cheese, bacon, and Cajun sauce. Available all day, every day at area Bojangles. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting the Encore Series, 5 Broadway shows, including The Lion King, Phantom of the Opera, Beautiful, The Carol King Musical, and more. Info and tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Well, social media has affected the world in many ways and to degrees we never could have imagined. From the Arab Spring to Moral Mondays, Facebook and Twitter users have used their networks for social activism. But how does online activism translate into real-life movements? We talked to a UNC professor whose work explores the power of technology on mobilization and on modern-day protests on this program tomorrow at 9. We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Robert Mueller's investigation is looking into Trump finances and Russia. So will we. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation coming up on On Point from 10 till noon, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about criminal justice, the criminal justice system transitioning from prison back to normal life, if that is even possible in some cases, and what is available for people coming out of prison. And this has stemmed from our public conversation on Charlotte's homicide count, which continues to rise. Gemini Boyd was on that program and said some fairly eye-opening things. We've invited him back to be with us today. He's a community activist and founder and CEO of something called Project Bolt, which we'll talk about in a moment. You're a felon. People with felons have, I think you're a felon, is that correct?
Oh, yes, I
okay.
am.
Okay. People with felonies on their record after they get out of jail have a really tough time because there are barriers to employment, there are barriers to housing. There are barriers to furthering public education, obstacles to health care, and, of course, in many states, felons lose the right to vote, which means they can't participate fully in society. And there are those who believe if you haven't got a stake in society, then you've got nothing to lose by hurting society. Talk about these barriers and what you personally have faced.
My personal experience, it was so, like, detrimental to me because it hurt knowing that, first of all, I went and I was away from my daughter, who I have one child, and she was 2 years old. And when I came home, she was 22. Mm. And me coming home, trying to find a job, try to better myself to stay out of what I had just went through. It's so heartening because individuals, once they're released, don't have the mindset that I have or the drive that I have to want to stay out.
Why not?
Because some individuals, like, it's an illness that, you know, we have to start recognizing.
That Frontline special that I referenced at the very beginning of the program, they followed 10 inmates through a federal prison, I think in someplace in New England. And one of the guys they talked to was having such an incredibly hard time getting a job, finding a place to live, finding food to eat, etc., that all he said is, I want to go back. I'm completely alone. I can't see my family. I can't get a job. I want to go back.
And a lot of them think like that because, like you say, there's no affordable housing. There's no job because of the box for felons that are on most applications. And then once you pass that barrier of check the box and you actually do an interview and they actually ask you about, you know, have you been incarcerated? It's kind of shameful. You're like, you don't want to really say, yeah, I was just released from prison, but I have, obtained my CDL driver license to try to get a better job.
Right.
But I can't even get hired. And I'm certified.
Plus, when you have that conversation, even in places where Ban the Box has taken effect, at some point they're allowed to talk about your past. And so when you say, well, I was in jail for 20 years as a convicted felon, you know, as you're saying it, that probably ends your chances of employment.
Exactly.
Right?
But
shame aside.
For me, there's no shame. I'm an open vessel.
Okay.
I refuse for you not to know. I prefer you to know what you're dealing with when you're dealing with me. Because once I tell you where I've came from, where I've been for the last 20 years, and you see someone different, you'll get a different outlook on individuals coming behind me.
So in our public conversation, you said that people who are released from prison have nothing. They have nowhere to go, nothing to do. So they have to resort, do they not, to the familiar ways of bringing in income, to find food, to find housing, correct? Which is crime.
And this is what the United States has created. They created this monster that they have right now, that they're dealing with right now. We have all these murders and right now in the city of Charlotte and in Chicago, where there's murders like every day and all throughout the United States. But we created this with the mass incarceration.
We're going to meet two women who are involved in a moment with organizations that that help people in this situation. And you started a nonprofit called Project Bolt, Building Outstanding Lives Together. Why does the world need another nonprofit to help people like you who got out of prison?
Because my nonprofit will be different from others. It's going to help bridge the gap with the individual in prison and the individual coming home and having him, he or she, to understand that there's someone just like you who went through the same things you went through. And we're going to bridge the gap with other reentry programs. But you shouldn't have to wait until you come home to try to find a reentry program. You need to know those things before you come home, years before you come home, not the day of that you get out. It's so hard, and it's so hard for the individual, because that's when he resorts back, because he gets frustrated. He or she gets frustrated, and they say, well, I ain't got to go through this. I know how to go get me some money, so I'm going to just go do it my way.
So when did this start? When did Project Bolt start?
It started while I was in prison.
Okay.
And it started 20 years ago. Project Bolt started 20 years ago because I refused to come back in the situation that I was in. Mm-hmm. So in order for me to do that, I have to do something constructive with my life. And I want to use my life as a platform. I want to use my life as a gateway to show individuals coming from prison that you can make a difference in your life, even though you've been convicted of a crime. That's where Project Bolt, that's where it came
from. So are you working with people right now?
Yeah, I work with individuals daily, every day. I even go to the halfway house here in Charlotte, and I work with individuals, and I try to talk to the counselors and stuff like that to let them know that I am available. If individuals need someone to talk to, because you have AA sponsors and NA sponsors, you actually need a sponsor for an individual that comes home from prison.
Are they taking you up on your offer to help?
No. And they're not taking me up on my offer because I just come from there. And I have this one thing that stands over the top of my head, and that's a felon. I'm a convicted felon. What I have to offer, maybe someone, they don't want to look at it as though I can help. But you, if it wasn't me and you had a title behind my name and you never met me before, because individuals with a title behind their name, they are reading a book that I wrote. So why not take the book, the author of the book, and have him show you what needs to be done? I wrote the book, but yet and still, I'm not the one who can actually teach from the book. You would rather take someone who never experienced anything like that in their life and try to tell you about something that you're the author of a book of, and they can't do that.
Let me go back to this attempt to ban the box. This refers to removing information about a person's criminal history on job and housing applications. It's a little box that you check. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? And you have to check that box if you have been. And then that takes your application and throws it essentially in the trash can for a lot of people. But North Carolina HB 409, which is our ban the box legislation, made it through the House. It stalled in the Senate and may or may not get picked up again in the future. I want to get your take on that legislation. But first, let's hear from Michael Cohen on the topic. He is a researcher in the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And he says his research on ban the box laws show mixed results.
What we found from that research was that ban-the-box policies are effective in getting employers to remove questions about criminal histories from their job applications, and they also increase callbacks for people with criminal records. And there's some case study evidence, which is a little bit less rigorous, that suggests it also increases employment. But on the other hand, when you drill down into the numbers, the likelihood of employers calling back or hiring young men of color actually decreased. And that's because employers, without this background check on the job application that proves that young men of color aren't criminals, they rely on racial stereotypes and end up making assumptions about people's criminal history based on race.
Institutional racism, I guess. He believes that ban-the-box policies, however, should be continued, he says, but that the unintended consequences for people of color should be reduced. So, first of all, do you agree with him on any of this? And secondly, how would you reduce those unintended consequences?
I mean, it goes back to where we are in society today. It's like no one will understand the individual that's actually trying to make a difference with their life. It's like you want to keep pushing the individual back to incarceration. We need to just totally ban that box and have more companies, Fortune 500 companies, actually take on individual. It can be a probationary period. If you give an individual, say, okay, we're going to give you six months on the job, and this is what our government or Mecklenburg County or North State of North Carolina actually needs to do. The government needs to step in and say, we're going to actually pay companies, and the company doesn't have to pay an individual. Like, say, for instance, if the salary was $20 an hour job, we would take, and we should say, we're going to take and pay the company, this individual, $12 an hour to work for this company, and you don't have to pay him. Put him on a probationary period. If he or she passes the probationary here and you see that this individual is never late for work, does an exceptional job at what it is that he or she does, then you can hire this individual on. And then this is how you break the barriers in the minority communities. You have to find a way that we can show individuals that you can make a decent living and you can earn money and still take care of your family, because most of the time, that's what it's all about. You're just trying to take care of your family, which leads to other things, which makes the situation even worse than what it was. So if we could actually take this and just change it totally, man, just get rid of it. But we have to have more companies to recognize that, okay, we got individuals that have been incarcerated, and we have to do something for them in order to make our country a better country than what it is, because it makes no sense that we have 2.3 million people incarcerated and you have other countries that are way worse with crime and everything else, and we're the land of the free, but we lead the nation in incarceration.
Lead the world.
World.
Yeah. Gemini Boyd is our guest. I'm going to broaden this conversation out to get a different perspective or a broader perspective of the challenges faced by ex-felons and to explore some of the solutions that are being floated. These are people with titles behind their names.
No pun intended. Please.
We're joined by Myra Clark and Shelley Listwine. Myra Clark is Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions. You've been helping people like Gemini since when?
Well, the organization's been around since 1974, and I've been with the organization for 30 years.
Okay. Dr. Shelley Listwine is a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte, whose research focuses on correctional rehabilitation and the use of best practices in prisons and out to reduce recidivism. Thank you for being here as well.
Great.
I want to talk about something that he mentioned, authorship. You guys, You're a professor. I know you do a lot of reading and research, but you've not been behind bars, I don't think, have you?
I have not.
As an inmate,
An inmate, correct, yes.
Same is true for you, Myra.
I have not.
True? So why are people reluctant to listen to people who have lived the life, who are trying to make a difference, trying to get through to people like themselves who are coming out and trying to rebuild their lives? Why are they not embraced by people and organizations like yours, Myra, for instance? Maybe they are, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But why aren't they embraced more?
Well, I think it's an individual choice that you want to do better. And so you look for resources that are going to help you. Now,
but I mean, in Gemini's case, he's offering his services and mm-hmm. his wisdom and his knowledge about what life's like inside, what life is like outside once you get out. And he can't – it's like banging his head against a wall.
Exactly.
Well, I do think they have different expectations. They think it's going to be different, and it's not until they get the folks who have been incarcerated.
I'm talking about organizations like yours, mm-hmm. not you personally. I'm not being
critical. Well, I have people on my staff who have been incarcerated.
Okay, that's what I want to know. Okay.
So I have folks who teach classes, who run a program, who provide information for folks, and in a way, I think – that folks listen, and they don't necessarily reveal that they've been incarcerated unless it becomes a situation where that could have an impact on the person they're working with.
Okay.
And so, I can't hire people. I can't ask employers to hire people who have a record if I've never done that. And so we kind of walk that talk in that way.
Okay.
So I do have folks who had similar situation than you when they were in prison. They taught classes. They taught anger management. So they did a lot of the things that you were talking about that you did while you were incarcerated. And today, they, you know, this one gentleman, Eric Ortega, he is the director of the LifeWorks program for our organization.
You study the behaviors and best practices, or recommend best practices, Shelley Listwine, in prisons. I guess it's not a bad thing to have somebody such as Gemini teaching other inmates while they're in prison about anger management or whatever the case may be, as long as they have gone through a program prior to that with an expert and a professional who helps them to recognize the things in themselves that they can then impart to other people who are in similar situations. Is that what happens? Or do they just throw these guys up and say, okay, you're teaching anger management?
Yeah, well, and I think it's interesting. I want to expand on something Jim and I talked about, which is our Get Tough movement. When we stripped the resources out of the prison environment, we did just that, which meant stripping out the staff resources. It meant stripping out all of the, you know, potential that the prisons had to actually rehabilitate people. And so by doing so, we made the environment harsher, more punitive, more coercive, with the idea that, oh, well, if we make it harsher, mm-hmm. people won't want to come back. Right. And so that's why we got rid of all the resources, thinking, oh, well, no one's going to want to come back to this harsh, stripped out environment. And I did a study where I interviewed 1,600 people, asked them those exact questions, and found that those who felt the prison was harsher, who experienced victimization, who felt the correctional officers were not treating them well, were more likely to come back.
Exactly.
Why?
More likely to come back.
Why would you want to go back to that?
Because of what it becomes, it creates this normalcy.
Is it like Stockholm syndrome?
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You come out, you're traumatized, you have these experiences with you, you come out, there's a lack of resources in the community. And it's not, I don't necessarily think people want to go back. It's not like they're thinking, oh, that was great.
Yeah,
no,
not
it's
it.
Not that. They don't want to go back.
Is it
becomes
the
a lack of opportunity.
It becomes the final choice.
Exactly.
It becomes the final choice.
And they have no other, like she said, it becomes the final choice because you have nothing to turn to. And it becomes a normalcy because once you're in there and you're incarcerated, you know what to expect if you go back. Mm-hmm. So I can go commit this crime and I know what to expect when I go back in there.
And you
I'm
going
to get
the
room
community.
And board, something to eat and things of that nature, and I ain't going to have to worry about
regimentation,
nothing.
And regimentation, and you don't have to worry about
exactly.
The heat's provided, the air conditioning.
Everything's provided for you. While some individuals, when they come home, they have to start, normalcy has to kick in. You have to pay bills. You have to find out how you're going to work. You have to find out how to make communications with your family. Because if you've been gone for over 10 years, you don't know no one in your family. You know, they don't know you and you don't know them. The relationship starts over.
That's right.
This is like returning veterans.
That's right.
Yes.
To some extent.
In a
absolutely.
Way. In a way. Because they've lived a life completely foreign to people who have not been in combat. And they come home and people just expect them, well, you're home. The warm embrace is here. And
some
doesn't
people
work that
find
way.
That analogy offensive. But I think your point, which is completely spot on, is
exactly.
that when you're exposing people to a hostile and coercive environment, you should expect some psychological
exactly.
results.
Exactly. That's what I was going.
Plus,
right.
But also, the family has been distanced. The family's life
absolutely.
Has gone on while you're in Afghanistan or while you're in prison. And when you come back, you have to get to know each other.
That's the question of, do you understand or do you believe that individuals coming home or is under post-incarceration syndrome?
We have to break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing private wealth management teams of Charlotte advisors to help look beyond the portfolio and prepare SunTrust clients for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. More info at suntrust.com/reserve. And WTVI PBS Charlotte presenting Carolina Collectibles Day, Saturday, September 16th, offering verbal valuations of family heirlooms at the studio. Details at pbscharlotte.org. President Trump's son-in-law appears before the Senate Intelligence Committee today as part of the Russia investigation. Jared Kushner says he did not collude with Russia during last year's election. Meanwhile, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation has expanded to look at the financial relationship between the president and Russian figures. All of those topics considered coming up during On Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And our conversation continues in just a moment. Stay with us.
The city of Detroit has a new employee, chief storyteller.
I loved growing up there. I had kids in the neighborhood that I went to school with over there. I used to catch the Dexter bus everywhere.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the new narrative of an American city, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Gemini Boyd, community activist, founder and CEO of Project Bolt, Building Outstanding Lives Together. He's a former inmate, served 20 years in federal prison. Prior to that, a three-year juvenile sentence. And now he's out trying to help others who are returning from prison. And there are millions of people out there who have returned from prison, because that's one of the things we don't think much about, is that most of the people who are sentenced to prison are going to get out, and then what? Joining us also is Myra Clark, executive director of an organization that has been doing the then what, Center for Community Transitions, and Dr. Shelley Listwan, professor of criminal justice and criminology at UNC Charlotte. One of the things that you do, doctor, is study best practices at various prisons around the country, and you also, as I understand it, train prison staff to help current inmates to reenter society. What kind of programs? Because essentially, Gemini said when he was there, nothing. There was That's nothing. Right. So what kind of programs are there, in your experience, in some of these prisons that you work with, to help people build life skills, get an education, deal with anger and addiction problems, et cetera, so that when they get out, they're not a menace to society?
Absolutely. So the good thing is, we were talking about the Get Tough movement before break, and now, you know, we've kind of started to move that back. And so there's a lot of, you know, good policy and research out there on what we need to do in terms of transitioning people back. And it's commonly said we need to start the day they enter, right? Not wait until the week before they leave, but the day they enter prison, in terms of working on what their particular needs are. And not everybody has the same needs. Sometimes it is substance abuse that's the problem. Sometimes mental health. Other times education, right? So you have to figure out what each person needs, start that process in the prison, and then transition that into the community.
Is that happening?
You know, it's happening sporadically. To have it happen on a national scale is difficult.
Let me ask you this, because you deal with prisons and you talk, I'm sure you talk to wardens and you talk to people who have been incarcerated, and you talk probably to prison guards, right?
Yep,
and counselors. How do the people who run these institutions view the purpose of their institution? Is it a place to lock people up to punish them for their crimes and let them out when the time has come? Or is it a place to change those people's attitudes and lives and habits so that when they get out, they won't be threatening anymore?
There's a number of states, North Carolina included, that are in that kind of group that say we need to rehabilitate. We need to change. We need to create a culture that is different so that when they go out, it's not just stepping right back into what they came, you know, to. Not every prison is like that. And oftentimes the warden, as you mentioned, is the one that kind of sets the tone for the institution. If it's at the federal level, that becomes kind of a larger federal policy.
Because the Charlotte Observer did that series not so long ago about some prisons in North Carolina where essentially the guards are criminals, because they're smuggling in drugs and cell phones to prisoners, et cetera, who are running operations outside the prison thanks to that.
That's right.
I mean,
this is changing the culture of the prison environment, and that starts top down, but also starts with training the staff, right? The third shift staff, the second shift staff, everybody to be involved and engaged in the rehabilitation of the inmate. That's a philosophical shift from punishing the
So you've been in this for how many years, Myra?
30.
30. You personally have been involved in helping people who are getting out of prison for 30 years at the Center for Community Transitions. And you've said that you do this work because no human being is disposable, and that you believe second chances are possible. Mm-hmm. So you've been doing this since 1998. What trends, if any, have you noticed among the people that you work with?
Well, I'll say I've seen the pendulum go this way, swing one way and then swing the other way. When I started, there was a lot of work being done about pre-release and aftercare and working with folks before they came out of prison to get them prepared and then when they're out. Today, we went to a pretty harsh period, I think, when we had a lot of people in prison and there were very few programs. And today, I think we're back at trying to provide services and getting people connected to the right places. So I've seen it swing from one side to the other.
But have you noticed anything in the psyche of the people that you're working with? As Gemini spoke about this this post-incarceration syndrome that really affects younger people, mm-hmm. and millennials who have grown up watching daddy being carted off to jail and everybody in the community being carted off to jail, which normalizes jail.
Right.
Have you noticed anything different in those people when they get out?
I have noticed some things that are a little bit different. I think one of the programs that we offer is a program for children of incarcerated parents to try to break that cycle. Mm. I have seen people come out and know that there are some resources, but it is not easy. I mean, when we talk about barriers, it's not easy. I think that people who... We have to help people see that there's some hope, because when you come out of prison, you think there's some hope, but the first time the door slammed in your face, it kind of disappears.
Do you have a parole officer?
Yes, I do.
So when you first got out, what did he or she tell you about what would be expected of you as an ex-felon
or an
ex-con?
They expect for you drug tests constantly, for you not to commit another crime, for you not to hang around anyone that has already committed a crime. But that lies a problem within itself, because...
How do you do that?
Exactly. How do you do that in the black community when over 60% of the people that are incarcerated almost are black people? So how do I tell you in my community right now, family members and all, you telling me I can't be around my brother? Or you telling me I can't be around my cousin?
But that is what they're telling you,
exactly.
Right?
And you're telling me these things, so... And this creates another problem with it. There's that rejection. The minute someone tells you that right there lies that trigger point in your mind again.
Well, the other thing is, it seems to me, that when you get out, you're not going to be living in the View downtown here.
You're not
50th floor of the View, because you can't afford it. You're going to have to go into a low-income, probably public housing situation, which is where a lot of this problem exists.
And you can't go to public housing.
Exactly.
Can't go to public housing. No. So where do you go?
That's the question.
Where do you?
If you don't, luckily, I have family members. I actually have family members.
But if your family, if you've been released from prison and your parole officer's sitting there telling you can't be around people who have committed crimes, who are dealing drugs, who are
you want to know where you go back to?
Where do you go?
Prison.
You go to the street.
You go back to prison. That's where individuals actually go.
In that Frontline documentary.
Which leads to prison eventually.
In that Frontline documentary that I referred to, one of the guys is standing outside the prison. He's just been released. They've given him this little bag full of goodies, toiletries, et cetera. And he said, well, I can't go to my family because they're criminals. I can't do this. I can't do that. I guess I'm going to stay on the street tonight.
Well, and that happens to a lot of people. We had a fella come through our program, and he slept on the street every night but showed up on time every day to be in our program. There are some transition homes, but you have to have money. And when you come out of prison in North Carolina, you get $45, and that's not enough to even pay for one night.
Of course not.
And so
– day and time.
And you may have some friends who'll let you stay, but they may not let you stay for longer than a couple of days, because if you can't contribute, then that makes it difficult.
I don't want to cut you off, but you take incarceration from the 70s and the 80s, where it was a least amount of people incarcerated. So you had more resources. They actually, in the federal system, they actually gave you $500 to $1,000 once you were released. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just some normalcy just to have some money in your pocket to not worry about the first night that you go home. $45 is not going to get you nothing. You can only eat at McDonald's one time and stop at the corner store and get a bottle of water, and them $45 is gone.
That's right.
And you expect the individual to come home and be stabilized.
Within the criminal justice system, doctor, is this discussed? Is the reality of this? This seems to be lunacy to me. I mean, you can't. Any thinking human being knows you can't live on $45.
That's right.
And then not be able to get a job, mm-hmm. or an education, or be around your family if they are criminals or they do drugs or they pass drugs around. What are you to do? Is this is this discussed?
Absolutely. And so one of the areas that North Carolina is doing is they're trying to establish reentry coordinators and then subsequently called reentry councils, where they're putting people in prisons, like a caseworker, to try to get inmates, you know, what services they need so they know where to show up on Monday morning. They know how to get that furniture. They know where they can go to live. Now, that's not to say that's a perfect system because, as Myra said, if you don't have the money or, you know, there's still all types of problems with it, but they know exactly that. You can't just let people out into a black hole and expect them to figure it out on their own and be successful, because none of us probably could do that unless we have the family support or something. So what?
And Mecklenburg has a reentry council. We've had one since 2005.
But on a state level,
That's right.
A lot of stuff we're discussing is on a state level.
Right.
And in most inner cities right now, you have more people on a federal level that they're being incarcerated at a high rate opposed to the state level, because the federal government is picking up everything. I don't care what it is. They just locking you up. And now when you come home, you don't have that where you can contact someone on the state level and know that, okay, here's resources over here. This is what you do, you know. So you have to bridge that gap and finding those resources and knowing the individual and be a medium. I want to try to be that medium to bridge these two together.
You deal with this and have been dealing with this, for the reality of the situation, for 30 years. What do you tell these people? How do you help them?
Well, we do try to, you know, we do the best we can is what I can say with as few resources, because there's still fewer resources. Housing is a terrible problem. And the shelter sometimes will take folks. Sometimes they won't take them because now there's the HUD definition of being homeless, and that creates a problem. And sometime later they may take them. There are a few halfway houses around town. We do have a reentry coordinator through the county that has some resources that she can put some people into some housing, but it's so limited, there's a long waiting list of folks who can't get into housing.
Let me share some comments that have come in from listeners as we've been talking. Tom on Twitter says, the chaplain in the prison at which I volunteered has been a lifeline, lifting men up and helping ready them for life beyond. Often, though, his hands are tied by the system in which he works. Increasing lockdowns, keeping men locked in their dorms, lack of funding all contribute to that. Helen on Facebook, this is of great concern in a nation that is the world's top incarcerator. This society judges criminal history like there is no redemption. Also, what about the families of the incarcerated? Which leads me to this, because you talked about this before, Gemini, that it isn't just the person being locked up who is impacted by his being incarcerated. It is their families. And because we've had this get tough on crime policy for so long and this war on drugs for so long, it now impacts the whole community, and not just the black community, although they bear the brunt of it. It's the whole community, because we're not dealing with a cancer here, and eventually I would think it's going to spread. How did your being locked up impact your family?
Well, first of all, I'd like to let you know that it is impacting white America right now because of the methamphetamine and the opioids that are being distributed throughout the country right now, and that they're being affected by at a higher rate now opposed to what young black males were being affected by. And once methamphetamine came into play, you had more, that was like a white man's drug, like those were the distributors of that. So now you see those individuals in prison now with 20, 30, 40 years, you know, and now they are going to have children and family members that are being affected by it. And then now you collectively as a whole now, you're just not pinpointing black and brown. And now you're actually bringing white America into this. And it's more of an eye-opener now that you're seeing white America involved in incarceration at a high rate. But it affected my family because I like to use a situation, not just me personally also, but just in a situation where an individual told me something and it was heartening for me to grasp. And that he was married and his wife was constantly coming to see him, like regularly. You know, he was married for numerous years. So once he was released, he discovered that his wife had became an alcoholic. And she became an alcoholic due to the fact of worrying about him while he was incarcerated, worrying about their kids. See, people in your family, they have to escape to something. Once they escape to something, it becomes maybe an addiction on their part.
You have a program, Myra, called Families Doing Time.
Mm-hmm.
that's an apt name, because they're also doing time while their loved one is
that's
in
exactly
prison.
Right.
How have you noticed it has impacted families who are left behind to deal with the world?
Well, families often tell me that they feel much more isolated, that people who used to support them or talk to them don't talk to them anymore. It is something that they find they can't really share with anybody because of the guilt and the shame of that. Children often act out because adults don't know how to talk to children about somebody who's not there anymore being incarcerated. They often tell them they're out of town in school or they're working out of town, but they're working out of town for 10 years. So for a very long time. And so one of our programs is EQIP, Empowering Kids with Incarcerated Parents. And we sit down with children and help them understand that. So they know that they're not alone, that there are other kids who are experiencing something similar to them.
And those kids, probably most of the time, they don't even know it. This is what's so strange, that you can be in a public school, go in a public school right now, and the group of individual kids that are hanging together, a lot of times they cling to each other, knowing that their parents, not knowing that each parent, each child has a parent incarcerated.
That very well could be true.
They automatically become friends without even knowing.
Yeah.
And then later on, they find out that my father, my mother is incarcerated.
I have 30 seconds left, and I know that you work with prisons again with best practices, and you're suggesting that prisons continue, if I'm not mistaken, continue to stay involved in their ex-prisoners' lives once they're released. Is that right?
Well, that there needs to be that transition. So really the best place is a reentry coordinator, a position, a person that works in that prison and checks up on the person and says, okay, now we know you're in the community now, but we're not just letting you go, right? And there should be that seamless transition from the prison to the community.
Dr. Shelley Listwan is a professor of criminal justice and criminology at UNC Charlotte. She joins us along with Myra Clark, executive director of the Center for Community Transitions, and the person who catalyzed all this, who triggered all this conversation, Gemini Boyd, a community activist and founder and CEO of something called Project Bolt, Building Outstanding Lives Together. Thank you all for your help.